Namaste, motherfuckers! Welcome to Namaste, Motherfuckers, the only podcast where the worlds of work, comedy, and well-being collide. I'm your host, Callie Beaton, and this episode is called If You Can't Stand the Heat. And to kick us off, despite all the TV cookery shows we have to choose from nowadays, the average Briton cooks half as much as they did in the 80s and only knows 4 recipes, which is 2 more than I know. My namesake, Mrs. Beaton, who is no relation, in her 19th century cookbook recommended boiling pasta for 1 hour and 3 quarters. So she was my kind of woman. The term slush fund comes from ship's cooks selling the fat gathered from cooking meat whenever they reached a port. The tall chef's hat traditionally had 100 pleats, which represented the number of ways an egg could be cooked. Calvin Klein kept a Pantone card in his kitchen so his chef could get the colour of his coffee exactly right. We don't know what the Pantone was though. And the word jabble, that's jabble, means to cook badly or with want of skill, which is the very opposite of today's guest.
I'm not sure about this piece of turbot and hollandaise in my background. I might just get rid of that.
That's my guest today, Jack Stein. And in honour of his wanderlust, a few globe-trotting chef facts for you. There's a pizzeria in Guatemala that cooks their pizzas on lava from an active volcano. The composer Rossini gave up composing to become a chef. He invented Tornados Rossini. Tornados Rossini. You can see I can't even say cooking things, let alone cook them. If you take a picture of your food in Germany, the chef legally owns the rights to the photo as it's considered their artwork. I think that's fair. And Swedish people think the Swedish chef Muppet sounds Norwegian.
Menopausal woman helping you with your tech.
That was brilliant.
That's humiliating.
Yeah, there we go.
Jack Stein is a celebrity chef born in Cornwall, middle son of Rick and Jill Stein. He kicked off his career as a kitchen porter during school holidays and at 16 moved to front of house, working as a waiter throughout the remainder of his education. He went on to chef at famous restaurants the world over, including La Régalade in Paris, before extensive travels to the Far East and Japan with a stint at Michelin star Tetsuya's in Sydney along the way. He has been chef director of all the Rick Stein restaurants since 2017, and his TV career is prolific. He's also author of the cookbook World on a Plate. Jack and I talked about parenting, time differences, cooking, travel, food, being ginger, Cornwall, chips, psychology, nature, nurture, fear of flying, tabloid press, fame, trolls, and love at first sight. Now, before we kick off confession time, the reason we talked about time differences might have been that Jack's over in Australia at the moment and I set up the recording for 10 a.m. his time, which was late night UK time, only I, in my infinite wisdom, assumed he was in Sydney, Australia, and it turned out he was in Perth. So when I called him, it wasn't 10 a.m. for him, it was actually 7 a.m, but legend that he is, he agreed to talk anyway. So I started by asking him where specifically he was recording from.
I'm in this art studio that my fiance's mum, she's an artist and an art teacher in Perth, so surrounded by kind of, I just love art. I love art studios because they're so chaotic, and I like it because it's sort of like my life in kind of personified.
Does everybody in your family have to be an artist, a designer, a cook? Could anyone be like, if there was an accountant, would they be allowed around the Christmas dinner table, or would your dog to piss off?
That's a funny question. I think we don't have any accountants. No, we don't. We have a doctor, but she's a psychiatrist, so it sort of makes that more sense.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, no, I don't think even any of the sort of, the partners are I can't think of, not that there's anything wrong with accountants. I mean, I found my own accountant this year for the first time. And I really like him. He's very, he's very, I just couldn't do the job.
You're not tempted to leave your fiance for him, though, are you?
I've not met him in person. It's sort of one of the things with COVID. You sort of, you kind of build a picture of somebody based on their voice, which is very strange. So I haven't met him yet, but yeah, you never, never say never. Never say never. I mean, he probably
No.
likes golf or something like that, so we could go for a long walk.
If we include this bit in the podcast, which we probably won't, but if we do, we've lost all accountant subscribers to Namaste Motherfuckers. I don't know how
There we
many of
go.
them we have, but we'll soon find out when we get hate mail for them. So is it, what time is it for you? Is it 7:15 then for you?
So I'm always up early though, because I come to this agreement with Lucy that I'll do the mornings with the kids. Since we sort of had kids, so my oldest is 3 and youngest is 2, and I give her a lie-in, and it's like this kind of, she doesn't realize, but I spend the whole morning trying to avoid waking her up until the latest possible. And my current record is like 11:45 in the morning, or 11:45 midday.
There's literally women going to be throwing their knickers at their devices at the thought that there is a man who, having impregnated you, might actually then be willing to look after the children till lunchtime every day. That's literally
Yeah.
like the dream ticket.
The best part was is that she missed her deadline on fantasy football and got really angry at me because she hadn't changed her team.
This feels like quite a role
She's
reversal
very
kind of a
bizarre.
relationship. I'm liking you two a lot.
I do a lot of cooking, and so I mean, so I'm always up, so I'm all good.
Well, that's good to know, because if you asked a comedian, if you suddenly asked a comedian to jump on anything at 7:15 in the morning, we wouldn't be awake. So, and if we were awake, you would get nothing coherent. So I'm glad that you do what you do for a living, not what I do. So
It's
thank you. We're
funny.
both are wakeful times. Me late at night, you early in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. It's a perfect harmony.
It is. And where are the we should just check that the kids' well-being, given that your fiance is asleep. I'm assuming someone is in charge of small children.
Yeah, so Lucy's mum and dad just got a knock on the door and a kids through the door sort of number. I said, I'm really sorry, but they're already up, so they're in there, I don't know, playing.
Did you sound really sober? But some moron in London can't do time differences.
No. No, I didn't say that. No, I didn't say that. I just said a little bit of crosswise with the size of Australia, because it's like we flew across it the other day. It took us nearly 6 hours, and I always marvel. I mean, I've been there a lot, but I always marvel when we come from the east to the west that you just it's like 6 hour flight from the UK. I mean, you could be one of many, many different places. It doesn't feel like anything like the, where you live. And in Australia, it's just one massive country.
I just was assuming East Coast all these years when I was sort of working in the business world, and I always had teams around the world. So I did many, many calls with Australia, but I was just ignorantly assuming, well, you're bound to be in Sydney or on that coast. So you even having sent me something saying where you were. So let's assume that it's good I don't have an executive job anymore, and I'm allowed to be mushy brained. But no, thank you so much for doing this. It's lovely to have a fellow ginger with a fellow Cornwall connection. I think that's those two. I think we must have had ginger guests on the podcast before, but I haven't had a fellow Cornish person. Not that I am Cornish, but I have roots in Cornwall, as you know.
No, I mean, I mean, if only I spoke fluent Dutch, it would be a triumvirate.
It literally would, wouldn't it? It literally would. Is it, and I did joke with you that all I would ask you is your favourite joke and how much do you think I've spent on your dad's chips? So it must, I'm sure you get sick of people talking about the price of Rick's, and they are good chips. I'm not going to argue about it. So for anyone, I mean, I think everybody knows you probably get sick of being referred to as Rick Stein's son, right? Because that's when you Google you, that is the first thing that comes up, which really, I think within a couple of years, when you Google your dad, it will say Jack Stein's dad. But at the moment, we're still at Rick Stein's son.
Yeah, it's funny if you, I guess you'll see, if you Google it, you might see net worth and wife, who is Jack Stein's wife. I think you made it when Google's sort of throwing these sort of search results up when you put your own name in. Not that I do it a lot, just a couple of times
Just twice a
a
day.
day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? It's a really interesting. Yeah, of course you can't get away from your parents. I mean, I've been very fortunate. Mum and dad have, worked extremely hard, and this feels like a politician's answer coming out here that I've trotted out.
Don't worry, we'll soon cut through that shit.
That's fine, yeah, let's get rid of it. It's like Bill Hicks said, I'm gonna plaster on a fake smile and plow through this shit one last time. And So, but they, you know, that I really like Professor Blakemore, who's a professor friend of my uncle's, who at Oxford, he's a, I think he's a neuropsychologist or neuroscientist. His daughter is interested in the psychology of teenagers, which I find really interesting. I did a psychology degree, and this is a very, very roundabout way of explaining what I'm trying to say. But basically, she said, because of her dad being a very famous professor, she was able to watch from the sidelines, learn a lot, and then when she got into her professional life, he was able to open doors which just wouldn't be open to her otherwise. And she said, you can't change who your parents are, but because of who my dad was, I was able to go to Berkeley and study at this laboratory. And I found myself listening to it going, that's really interesting, because she's not being sort of deprecating and saying, you know, anything other than the facts. You can't change your parents have opened doors for you. And myself have been able to travel, eat great food, and worked in some of the best restaurants in the world, all because of my surname. And that is, you know, both a positive, and it can be considered negative as well, depending how you look at it. But for me, I just think that that's been such, you know, travel and food are two things that are very close to my heart and will continue to be close to my heart for the rest of my life. Parents have given me a love of those two things, which I think is great, you know. And I think if you can instill a couple of things in your kids that they really are going to go off and enjoy for the rest of their lives, and you've done extremely well. And I've been lucky to work in some great places and make some great friends and contacts along the way. So it's kind of, yeah, again, you know, it can happen in any strata of society, whether it's, you know, you can make the same argument about, you know, people who go to Eton and they get this golden spoon in their mouth, and you can argue this that maybe I've had something similar, but I'm very lucky. All I can say is I'm very lucky. It's what I keep coming back to when I think about my life and how I've got where I am. I've just been very fortunate, you know, white male, albeit ginger hair, which when
I
I
mean,
was young,
ginger's a little bit of a strike
ginger.
against. So yeah, if you're trying to put that through as a that you've kind of conquered some sort of. By the way, sorry if you could hear a cat purring then. She's like, normally you're cuddling me reading a book at this time. What are you doing? And is it because one of the things though that I think is the fact is the business you're in. And by the way, I should declare that I'm probably the least skilled person in the kitchen that you'll ever have spoken to in your entire life. So we're on uncomfortable ground if we get into any specifics. But I do know that working in your industry, in terms of how you start out, right, there's no shortcuts. You had to work your way up from kind of busboy on up, I'm presuming. There was no way to just go steaming in and being a brilliant chef.
No, and I think, you know, when you it's a family business, so you know, childcare is expensive. Work paying me £2.50 an hour to wash pots was cheaper than, you know, paying for childcare. So we, you know, parent, mum and dad worked all the time, and we did, you know, we were very, very aware that the business was really important. And but we used to work as kitchen porters because it was, like I say, cheaper than childcare. So we'd get, like, you know, we'd earn a bit of money over the holidays, and we'd learn, you know, that the kitchen starts from the people who wash the dishes and wash the pots, because without them the whole thing collapses. And it's, if actually, if you talk to most chefs started as a kitchen porter, they call them, which is the, you know, it's the sort of, like, nice way of saying you wash pots. And yeah, and it was a real, you know, it was a real kind of education in the industry. And I think that, you know, shit, like you say, you don't just go in as a head chef, you do work your way up. So I did front of house for a long time, which I think for a chef, one of the big things that I think chefs often are guilty of doing is thinking the food, when you put it on a plate and then somebody takes it through the door, that's the end of it, you know. But they forget that there's people out there, real people who can be, we're allowed to swear on this podcast, aren't we,
Absolutely. I
because of
think
the
the
name.
title's the clue, Jack.
They can be absolute wankers, you know.
Yeah.
Do you know who I am? That kind of, you get asked, do you know who I am, and you don't know who somebody is, it's extremely embarrassing, because A, you think they've forgotten their own name, which is, you know, your whole different kind of realm of worry for the person. And or secondly, you just think they're a complete tosser. And you get a lot of that. And I think chefs kind of, for me, I was able from an early age to kind of appreciate that the industry is not just the cooking. It's the whole hospitality side. It's making sure people are happy, making sure that the plastic plants are being wiped of, you know. I mean, these jobs that you do in front of house, just you just can't believe, you know, cleaning glasses, cleaning plants, cleaning up after people when they've left. So yeah, it was a real education. And mum and dad, I think, were really, really kind of keen for me to learn from the ground up, because again, being the son, you or being the child of a of the owners, you don't want to just come in and put a suit on and breeze around and tell people what to do, because people will just think you're a right dick.
So you're the middle child, first of all. So what's that like? I'm the youngest. So it's so, and all three of you have ended up in the dynasty, albeit in different ways, right? So your little brother and you were on the kind of cooking side, and your big brother's on another side of the business. Is that right?
Yeah. So the business splits between mum and dad. So I work with dad, and mum and Ed and my older brother and Charlie work with mum. So Charlie does wine, which is the best. You know, he's picked the best job.
That is a nice job. Surely you don't get your hands too dirty doing wine, do you?
No, you just get pissed all the time. I mean, you know, the other day he was, you know, he'd sort of flown back from a, you know, weekend away with some top VIPs in Burgundy, and then was in Heathrow. We both hate flying, you know, and had a few drinks, and he'd done what we always talk about when we do end up getting on a plane absolutely hammered. Is to
wait,
say,
wait, you hate flying, even though you love traveling, you hate flying.
Yeah. So I have to get pretty drunk before I get on a plane. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, but then when I'm drunk, I'm just like smile. I don't make any noise. I've never been rumbled for being drunk on a plane, but if you ask
me... Not that you remember.
No, but I often don't remember taking off, to be honest. But anyway, Charlie said, oh, I'm just, I'm in departures. I'm going to Barbados. So we went to Barbados for a day, which made me laugh, because I'm like, you're in wine. You know, I'm sat here in the kitchen. You know, you've gone to Barbados and back in the day, which seems a bit bizarre. But, you know, you're drinking all the time and having a great time. So he's probably picked the right horse when it comes to the business, because you're right. Wine is just, it's just always fun, always fun.
So no sweat and a lot of fun. So he's doing wine. Yeah. And Ed, so you're, because your mum's a designer, right?
Mm. So Ed does the interiors and the project. So again, if you can picture the two offices, they're at the end of one building above our chippy where you've been. A lovely view.
By the way, you say chippy. It's quite glamorous for chippy.
Yeah. So you get the smell of fish and chips all day, and it doesn't make you want to eat them. But so mum's office is like Google, you know, and I went to the Google offices once. People always say, oh, it's like Google offices. I went and did an event in the one in the King's Cross one, the one that's going to be replaced by the land scraper, whatever they call the thing coming up. And over in mum's office, there's like, you know, there's a baby and a cat, not a cat, but like a dog. And like, it's very like, you know, there's interiors and swatches and like, you know, bits of material and that, this, that, and the other. And dad's office is much more kind of big chair, you know, sort of white cat, kind of, you know,
Austin Powers.
You're going to do what I tell you. Bit like that, yeah. And he said a great thing to me. He's, I don't want to be dogmatic, but this is exactly how I want it. And I was like, yeah, there we go. the dictionary definition of dogmatic there. So we sort of work in the two different sides. But I mean, I love working with dad because he's, you know, he's my hero. Like, I genuinely do have a lot, so much, like, time for my parents, how hard they've worked and everything like that. And watching a really great creative person do what they do is, and being on the sidelines and watching, you know, him sort of do everything he does through business and also the TV and stuff, it's great because you realize he just has a natural talent for it, and it's amazing to watch. And like, you know, I wouldn't have the experience of being able to do that had I not gone to work in the business. So I'm very happy, even though it can be trying at times because it's your family, and you know, families row and this, that, and the other. And sometimes the exec, I mean, you know, you've been an executive, but being an executive at a family business, I don't know if you've ever done that, but it's like,
no, my parents, you know, were teachers. There was no call for me to get involved in their lives.
If you've got, so you're in a boardroom and the family start, you know, wobbling and fighting, and sometimes some of the execs we've had in the past have literally looked like, you know, God, what's going on here? But with your family, you sort of always forgive each other and kind of, you know, you move on. So yeah, interesting dynamic. Very happy to be part of it. It comes with its sort of its stresses and foibles.
It's funny because I interviewed Wayne Hemingway, and I'm sure you know, founder of Red or Dead, and he's massive.
Yeah, yeah.
He's really big into family and very similar to your setup, really. Hemingway Design, it has now got his adult children very much involved in it. And hearing him talk about the subject of family is quite moving, actually. And he talks, yeah, he talks fairly honestly about it. But for him, it's the complete mainstay, and it's what he kind of grew up with as a values system, even though he didn't have a sort of dad present in his life. And so is that, when you look at that family unit, is there, because I don't, lots of people listening either won't have a good relationship with their parents, might not have parents, might not be able to countenance working with their family. Was there a sort of breakaway bit in your teen years where you were like, screw this, I'm not my parents, I'm going to go do something else, and that you came back to it? Or did you always feel quite aligned with what your parents do?
Yeah, I think definitely that happened. I mean, they kind of tried to get me to go and do something else as well. They were like, you know, don't come into the business. It's a bit of a nightmare. You got to remember that the food and drink, and especially chefing and the restaurant trade, in the sort of mid-90s when I was going through my kind of secondary schooling, was coming out of a real long period of difficulty in the UK. You know, it's hard, long hours, not particularly well. You know, there's a few great restaurants like the Ivy and Caprice and these kind of like really, really well-known restaurants in London, but the actual industry was in a pretty bad state. So they didn't want me in it. They said it was too much, you know. So I went off and I did a degree. I did a psychology degree and was sort of really into the kind of science of, you know, I worked a lot with, you know, my dissertation was on Asperger's syndrome, and I was really into kind of the kind of clinical side. And I have some friends down in Devon who have kind of done this amazing like service for people with learning difficulties, and one of them grew up in a home, you know, like back in the day when everyone was kind of lumped together, mm-hmm. before everyone understood the different needs of different kind of learning, you know, difficulties or, you know, whatever. He really kind of instilled in me this idea of like, you know, using kind of your brain to kind of do good for people. And it was really like, I was really close to kind of moving over, to be honest.
And when you say moving over to becoming a psychologist or?
Yeah, clinical psychologist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my cousin is a clinical psychologist. My other cousin is a psychiatrist. So, and we often talk about, you know, I often talk to them at Christmas, and I'm very, really interested by the research into it. And I know you've got some, you know, some personal history with it, and I understand the kind of issues around it. And I just find it fascinating how you can go from, you know, this situation my friend was in, with living in a home with 50 people with you know, learning disorders and different conditions, from that in the 60s to now all these people living in their own houses, having their own care and personalized care to different kind of conditions, and, you know, going and working with people with Rett syndrome and Down syndrome and Asperger's, and seeing how back in the day it would have been horrific, you know, for everyone to be in the same, you know, just a bit like an old people's home, you know, where everyone's kind of there because they're old, and that's the conditions that people were put in back then. And I was really kind of moved to do it. It was just that at the time I was, you know, I was offered the chance to go and work in the city, which is a bizarre kind of juxtaposition, but I went to work for do some work experience in the city for a big kind of insurance broker called Willis, and I went there as a work experience student, and I saw a completely different lifestyle. You know, it was like all money, and you know, it was just, it actually was during September 11th I was actually there in Willis, and Willis were brokers of, I think, you know, the trade centers and American mm-hmm. Airlines potentially. So it was very full-on hectic kind of period of my time, and they were offering me a job, and I was like, you know, I've got, you know, really divergent path here, you know, kind of Robert Frost would be, you know, frothing over this kind of difference here, and I went I was thinking I'm going to take this job in the city because it was all kind of, you know, there's money, and I guess I was in a period of my life where I just felt that maybe that was the way to go. I think given the choice now, I would have gone the other way 100%. But then I had a conversation with the chairman of the company. He came down to Cornwall and said, "I've, you know, I hear they've offered you a job, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "I wouldn't take it." And I said, "Oh, why is that?" And he said, "Well, you know, you've got this great business down here. All my staff are, you know, hardworking, you know, city type. You know the type, very kind of macho kind of place back then." And, mm-hmm. and he said, "And they all burn out and they all want to get a house down in Cornwall and live down here when they're 45. You're already down here. So why not just take this business on and run it like with the family?" I think it was a nice way of him saying, probably they should never have offered me a job, and he probably fired the person. But that's why I ended up back in the business. And it threw me out of my degree, sort of spun me round. And before I knew it, I was back in the company. So that was kind of my big flirtation with doing something very divergent from and I, and to be honest, I still think part of me, I guess the question is, if you didn't have the business, what would you do? And it would be in clinical psychology.
So you had a sort of, and I guess that was the kind of separation and exploring stuff that wasn't immediately assuming you go into the family business. And then, and actually I'd never thought of it that way, that yeah, most people are working their lives to be able to have a place in Padstow or the area, and you had the place and everything set up for you. Yeah. And is it, if you think about the, well, I guess an obvious question is, how is learning to cook? So it's not a given just because you're Rick Stein's son that you would necessarily be a good cook. Your brothers have both gone into other stuff. I don't know whether they're good cooks or they're not, but they're not doing it professionally like you. So how does Rick Stein's son learn to cook?
Well, he didn't ever, first of all, he never taught me to cook. So the only thing he ever taught me was how to slice bread. I think I was
good. And it's the only skill I have, really good bread. Yeah.
There we go. I'm not telling you anything you don't know already, but he definitely had a couple of drinks. He came into the kitchen for like a midnight snack. I think I was revising for my GCSEs and probably doing last minute revision at like midnight, and he came in and he was like, Jack, he called me son. He never calls me, he said, son, come here. So I was like, oh god, what's going on here? And he goes, I'm going to show you something. I said, all right. And he goes, I'm going to show you how to slice bread. And I sort of, you know, when you know that age where you sort of start to realize your parents aren't kind of, you know, these kind of all-seeing kind of omnipotent god-like figures. I've gone, oh god, here we go. And he showed me, and he sort of bent over the bench, grabbed a knife and a loaf of bread, and he started to slice. And he did this, so he goes, it's a sawing action, you use a whole arm. I said, oh yeah. I said, thanks a lot. And he went off. And to this day, that's the only thing he's ever shown me how to do in a kitchen. Like never, he's obviously an amazing sounding board now. We talk about food all the time, but he's never actually physically shown me how to do anything. So it didn't exactly set me up.
So he did. It's funny because you always say I can't even boil an egg, and now the saying should be I can't even slice a loaf of bread. So I can now boil an egg and slice bread. I'm feeling pretty accomplished, so thank you. And so he didn't teach you, although I'm assuming via osmosis, being in the environment of one of the world's most gifted chefs didn't hurt your, something must sink in, right? If you've got that in your orbit from when you can remember.
I think, again, that would be the osmotic kind of like, feeding of taste and what tastes good. I did have that, and I found that out at university when I was, you know, friends were making kind of, you know, pasta with Dolmio or, you know, some brand of pasta sauce, and I was kind of knocking up pasta sauces, you know, for fresh, and it was never really like a kind of like snobby thing. It was just like I suddenly realized people would come round to our place, to our like student kind of digs in the first year, and kind of come round for food quite often. And then by the second year we were having kind of little dinner parties at home, and it was, you know, don't get me wrong, I was drinking loads of Stella and eating a lot of kebabs, and that's why I stayed at university for 5 years.
There's
no two ways about it. Absolutely, yeah. but I was, you know, I was aware that I kind of understood how things should taste. So when I got into the kitchen eventually, I found it quite easy. But I think the biggest thing, and I think Rick would, Dad, I call him Rick sometimes, because when I was front of house, you can't go and say, you know, you're talking to somebody and say, oh, Dad, you know, you have to say Rick. So I learned this kind of, I had to use the word Rick. And if I was sat talking to a table for too long, really nice couple, we say, for argument's sake, and we're talking about stuff, occasionally we'd drop in Dad, and they'd be like, did you say Dad? I'm like, oh, he's like a dad to us all, you know, sort of thing. So that's why, if you wonder why I occasionally call him Rick. But Rick,
I thought you're just a very bohemian Cornish family where everyone's first names only.
But my eldest son started calling my fiancée Lucy since she's been here, and she only calls her dad Charlie or Camilla, who's Italian. And I said, well, you do the same to your parents. And she's like, yeah, but it's different. I was like, it's not different.
I think they do it to wind you up at a certain point. They definitely do it. My kids definitely went through that phase. Now they can't even remember my name. But for a while, it was just great sport to them. So, yeah, you were saying about your dad.
I think it's about organisation and chaos. So kitchen. So I am a fairly chaotic kind of person in my personal life, in terms of not very organized. I'm pretty forgetful. Every kitchen has a place for my keys, because I'll famously walk into any kitchen and before I could be in there for 2 minutes and I've left my keys somewhere, and they've all realized that they just find my keys and put them on the shelf or this little hook. So I'm very chaotic. But when I'm in a kitchen, when I'm faced with, like, you have to be very organized to cook. It's the one thing that I'm really organized, and it's the one place in my mind when I'm sat cooking that everything is how I'd imagine somebody who's very organized lives their life. And it's a little through the keyhole moment to a life that I wouldn't want to lead all the time, but it does make me realize that when my mum says I'm really disorganized, I always say, but in a kitchen I'm not. So it sort of, it does relate to my mum and dad. I think my dad had the same thing talking to people. I mean, I work with him as a kitchen porter, but I never cooked alongside him, although I have, like, in demos, but I've never cooked alongside him day to day, which is where you really see somebody's kind of chops. You know, you don't, if you do it just for a one-off demo, you can kind of put it on. But people who work with him on alongside him would say he was extremely organized when he was cooking, but the moment the check stopped, he would just be all over the shop. And that's basically me. So I think that cooking to me, although it really is painting by numbers, but it's also about living a different life. It's a kind of like acting for me, because I am not, like, you know, people that I've cooked with would say, God, he works really clean, like his section's always really spotless, his mise en place, which is all the prep work you do, is always, like, really good. And then they just get in my car and be like, what the hell has gone on
Are
here? Do you
there
know what I mean?
animals
It's
living in
like,
this car? What's the deal? Is
and
it it's
that's
really
it.
funny you say that though, because it's like it is obviously a version of you who's in the kitchen and being organized, but it's funny how the thing we do that is the thing everybody thinks is the difficult thing. I don't know if this is the same for you, but I find life never easier than the bit on stage. So by the time I'm on stage and doing my thing, it's like a sort of knife through butter, through, I should say, a warm knife through not cold butter. But is whereas there's other bits of life that other people seem to do really well, and I'm like, oh, I find that quite difficult. And is that so? It's almost like it's not a fake thing, but it's like that bit is very honed. And also, I suppose a bit like a performance, you know, when you've got to get food out of the kitchen, there's no fucking around. There's people waiting for it. And it's the same with what I do. You know, if you're told you're on stage at 11 and you're off stage again at 11:30, it doesn't matter what has happened. There's no being late and there's no leaving early. You know, you just got to get the job done. So something clicks in that is very sort of streamlined and pure. But is there any sort of, does any of that echo with how it is for you in the kitchen?
100%. 100%. I mean, it's very, I mean, yeah, you couldn't, I mean, it's like you're inside my brain. That's exactly how it is. And I find it incredibly easy and incredibly, like, you know, both cathartic but also inspirational, and in, but I enjoy it. And that's why I do it. That's not, you know, I sitting in an office, and I have sat in offices, and I've done, you know, spreadsheets and looked up at the clock, and it just doesn't move. Like, it doesn't move ever. And my brain just can't focus on that kind of those sorts of tasks where it's, you know, you're just doing these sorts of jobs, which is brilliant. People are brilliant at. But me in a kitchen, honestly, the day goes so fast, and I enjoy it, and I laugh, and I, like I say, it's the easiest thing to do. But what I think most people would, like you say, would think would be the hardest. And I think it also, live TV is like that for me. So I do the Steph show on Channel 4, people go, oh God, I couldn't do that. Oh no, I couldn't, you know, not live TV. I'm like, it's so easy. You just do it once. You know, what's the worst that's going to happen? I was on there the other day. I had no gas. I was cooking chicken and I had no gas. I had to pretend to cook. And it was like, and people are like, oh, how did you cope? I would have just, but it's like, I find it really easy because it's when you're under the, almost when you're in the most pressure is where I find myself, where you've got nowhere to go,
Yes.
no one to blame but yourself if it goes wrong. I find that really, living on that kind of edge, I find it really kind of invigorating, and it makes me do the best work. Do you see what I mean?
Not as much as the edge as if the crew had eaten that uncooked chicken. That would have been living on the edge, and that would have been
Well,
a bad
that
story for the Stein
would
Empire. But luckily, you were like, don't
absolutely
eat it. I've made
fortunate.
it look good, but please
Yeah,
don't
just
touch
do
it or
not
eat it.
touch it. Yeah, no, I just think that I think that's, you've hit something, it sort of struck a chord with me there. And I think that's where, again, I think it's down to the locus of control for me again. Like, you've got, you know, you, it's all on you. It's your, you're completely responsible for your destiny. And that's where I think that I find I work really, really well. And when I think that somebody else is doing the work for me, I'm pretty lazy. I mean, I'm phenomenally lazy when I can't, when I need to be,
It's funny
or when I
that
can be.
I feel like that you're in my brain now, because I'm this, no one would think, anyone who knows me would be like, you are not lazy, but I'm either on or I'm off. There's absolutely no, I'm nailing it or I'm doing absolutely sod all, and there's not much in between time. But do you find It's funny when you, when I, and again, I have no understanding of what it's like to do what you do creatively and culinarily, but it's, I do know, when I do things and anyone asks me to script it or rehearse it, like this week I was doing a big hosting thing for a corporation for like thousands of people, and they made me do a tech rehearsal. And in the tech rehearsal, they wanted me to run through, they'd done me a sort of auto cue script, which I then obviously was going to disregard. But then they were like, "Will you do some of the stuff you're going to do?" And I literally, I knew, even if I made any of the like little jokes or ad libs or whatever, that in the rehearsal it would screw it up for me on the day. And so I sort of had, and they were also like, "Can you send over the points you're going to say?" And I just, I'm sorry, but I just don't work like that. And if you give me parameters, I promise you I'll keep within the parameters and I will get through the content. But you're going to have to let me work live. And then it did all come together today. Whereas at the rehearsal, I was actually really, I think they were probably thinking, "Oh Christ, we've made a terrible mistake. She seems really wooden and out of it." And I kind of was, because I couldn't engage until the lights were on and the audience were there and it comes out. And is there a similar thing with the kind of cooking, like if you over prepped or had to do it once and then do it for real, it would be harder for you?
Yeah, I think I'm literally 100%. Like, I will often do things where, and people will go like, "If you practice this," I'll be like, "No, it's fine. Don't worry about it." It's like that. It's much. It will come much more naturally to me if you just let me crack on with it. And because I think that pressure, just that, just and that, my brain just is just. It's like, you're on a thin line. You've got one chance here, and you're going to make it. But if I, yeah, when I do rehearsals, when I do anything. Try and do anything prep wise. I never bother. I know full well, like, if I've done it once, I won't be able to do it, nail it again. So I'll, like I say, leave it to. It's exactly what I do. I mean, people are. I mean, I did. What did I do? I was doing this thing on Cooking with the Stars with AJ Dudu, and we were doing this paratha, and so it's like a layered bread which you put butter through, a bit like sort of puff pastry, but they're really nice. If you're ever in an Indian restaurant, order one as opposed to a naan bread. They're like flaky and really delicious. And like, I YouTubed it in the morning. Like, I'd never made one, never made one. I what look at this lady making one on YouTube, and I've gone, right, fine, I can sort of figure that out. And then we did the training with her, and I said to her, "I tell you what, I've never made this before, but no one's gonna know. And we made it on the training day, and they came up perfectly. And she was just like, after, she's like, "How could you do that? How could you just, like, And I'm like, "It's just like confidence. I know I can cook. I know I can watch YouTube. I can put the two together, and I can act like I know exactly what I'm talking about. But between me and you, I've never made this before."
So
And it
finally, we
worked
found out,
perfectly.
how did you learn to cook? YouTube, that's all I needed to know. And
Yeah,
it took us 20
there
minutes
you
to get to that. So
go.
you're talking good game. But now we know that we can all do it.
Namaste, motherfuckers!
I don't know the politics of your world, and I don't know what the different chefs think of each other. And I'm sure there are, and I'm not asking you to get into anything kind of controversial. But when a sort of muggle like me, who's not in that world but eats in nice restaurants sometimes, when I think about the sort of the big name chefs. So one of the things that I've, and I won't name names, but through my sort of prior life when I was on other people's dollar going to lovely restaurants and Michelin star restaurants and all the rest of it. One of the things I used to most hate was when a sort of celebrity or major name chef would come out and only, and they'd have mates there or people who were special, people like famous people are in or whatever. And then they went and really gave attention to a table or two tables who were like special people. And then I'd be thinking, okay, so if I'm not one of those people, I now feel like a complete second class citizen, but I'm still spending money in your restaurant. So is that something that you recognize when I'm saying that, of sort of the kind of mutual sycophancy of celebrity chefing and celebrities dining in those places?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, I'm probably guilty of doing the same thing myself, to be honest. But I mean, I get,
That's
I
what I'm trying
think,
to do, is shame you, Jack. If you've ever done that, you're a dick, is
no,
what I'm
no, yeah,
saying.
it's fine. Yeah. What I mean, I guess it depends. Sometimes, yeah, if it's celebrities, it's slightly different. I wouldn't go out and see a celebrity in the restaurant, unless they've asked to see me. I wouldn't, it just that wouldn't, I mean, we do, we've had, our restaurant, we've had everyone from, sort of Bowie to, to Cameron, politicians and celebrities. Never, I'd never go out and see them. I'd go out and see people in the industry. If it's a chef who's dining with us, or somebody who's used to work for us, I'd go out and see them. But I wouldn't go and
Or
see
a
chefs.
TV
But there is,
commissioner
I
from
mean,
Channel
that
4.
absolutely, yeah, 100%.
Have some more
hello,
wine from my brother
give us a
Charlie.
job. But that, I think though, I guess the industry, the restaurant, being a chef. and being an A-list celebrity. It's probably the closest you'll ever get to being an A-list celebrity is when you are a chef and you want to book a table somewhere, because you can pretty much get a table anywhere if you're in the industry and you're well-liked. And I think that the broader point about chefs in general is, I think in any industry, one of the things that, you know, I often say to young chefs is, you've just got to remember it's a very small industry. You know, it's not, you know, it may seem massive when you're a young chef and, you know, you've got like Heston Blumenthal and Gordon Ramsay and Rick and all these other great chefs, and you know, but actually when it comes down to nuts and bolts, like the entertainment industry and like TV, it's actually quite small, and people figure out quite quickly if they think you're a dick. You know, when I guess that's where like, you know, you book a table in a restaurant in London that you can't get a table in, and then you know you'll get a table if you're a chef, because everyone looks after each other. So it's kind of yeah, the egos and stuff in the industry, I think it's overplayed. I would say, like, by and large, a lot of it is kind of played for TV, of kind of, and when you get a nice organized kitchen, they don't shout. You don't get, you know, you use curse kind of short Anglo-Saxon occasionally, because it's quite easy to get your point across by saying you're fucking this, that, and the other, rather than having to do the sort of, you know, the HR. Now, HR would love us to talk in kind of, you know, long sentences. And, you know, I think you've got a training need that is not being fulfilled here, as opposed to saying you're a fucking knob, you know, get me that.
So there's no time for diplomacy, rather than there's a lack of respect or a kind of nastiness behind any of it.
No, I mean, like I say, there are some angry chefs out there, don't get me wrong. But I think the ones that you think are going to be angry, the bigger names, you probably find actually are the most organized. You know, like Gordon's a great example. You know, I know Gordon really well. I know people have worked for him. He's the nicest guy you'll ever meet. And his kitchens are the best. He's the best cook. I believe he's the best cook that has ever come from the UK.
Really? That's really interesting.
Yeah. And I know people that have worked with him and people that still work with him. And, you know, he is... When you see him, he knows all about, you know, what's going on in your kind of industry and your life, and he knows Mum and Dad really well, and you see him all the time. He lives down near us, and I think, you know, he's an amazing, you know, character on TV. You know, there is no doubt that he's got the most amazing presence for a chef. He's exactly what you imagine a chef would be. You know, he's perfect as a character, but actually, his kitchens are the best in the country. You know, the cleanest, the most organized. You know, he's got that many Michelin stars, and that's not because, and he's the hardest working guy that there is. You know, you go down the road to a local pub in a kitchen where the kitchen's disorganized and it's dirty and it's, you know, all over the place, you'll see shouting and people throwing pans around down there, but that's more because they're disorganized
and they're out of their depth, you know, and panicking. Is it I find after a life working in television that I find it very hard to relax watching television still, because I'm deconstructing everything, and I find it incredibly hard. I'm just about now, a few years out of my full-time job in telly, just about starting to enjoy watching it again, really enjoy it, and not think about having to do something professional with it. Is there an equivalent for you then, that if you're out eating, that you can't tune out the kind of quality of what's going on from front of house through to the kitchen?
No, I'm very, I mean, again, that's quite often a question you will get asked is, you know, what's it like to cook for a chef, or what's it like to be cooking in a kitchen when a chef comes and sits down? To be honest, I completely zone out. I don't, like, you know, the act of cooking for somebody, whether it's, you know, whether it's, you know, at home and somebody's just that can just about boil an egg and do some toast. So if I come around to your house, Kelly, there, the act of putting food in front of somebody, to me, is it's all about that. Nothing else. It doesn't matter what it tastes like. It's a really romanticized idea, but I just think that the act of going to preparing food for somebody else is enough. It doesn't matter. If you said my lasagna is the best in the world, then I might go, oh, well, your seasoning's off, you know, your pasta's rubbish, you know, be a bit more critical. But that's like a very different state of affairs, and I'd never be critical unless it's something that's really, like, unless it's something that I think is going to affect another person in the restaurant. For if something comes out and it's really bad, and I'm thinking they're serving that all night to somebody, and it's going to affect a few other people, yeah, something's seriously wrong, I probably would say something. But I would, you know, I'm not particularly picky, and I'm not particularly fussy. To be honest, we don't, you know, as a family, I didn't even eat in a Michelin starred restaurant until I was nearly 30 with
Dad. Oh, really?
He never took us. Yeah, he just, you know, we'd eat off the streets, and we'd eat the, you know, kind of really kind of rough places. And not, probably because he's a bit tight, maybe, but mainly because he just,
it's all about really, the margin.
The Michelin thing. Exactly. Yeah. But the Michelin thing, I think, is an interesting one. And again, you know, I think it's an interesting, you know, when you look at the industry, you look at the entertainment industry, for, you know, you look at things like, you know, the Emmys, the Oscars, whatever you want to say, you know, these the Michelin guide is like that for chefs. You know, it's like that kind
It's like
of,
a sort
you
of
know, you have to
snapshot.
reward. Yeah, and I think you have to reward hard work, and there has to be a way of, even though for me personally, the best meals I've ever had haven't necessarily been in the three Michelin star restaurants I've eaten in. Some of the best meals I've had have been in three, two, and one, but it's not a guide to me of the best of food, but it is a guide of how hard people work. And I think that people who are sniffy about Michelin forget that to be a Michelin, you know, Simon Rogan from Longclume in Carmel in the Lake District just got his third Michelin star. Now, I've known Simon since I first met him in Copenhagen at this kind of, you know, conference for world kind of hipster foodies. And he has been the most driven, dedicated chef. And to think that it's 10 years later, he's finally got his third Michelin star is just incredible. And I, you know, hats off to him. It's not what I would want because it's not my kind of food to cook, but you've got to appreciate that it's sort of, it has to be some kind of recognition for hard work.
I think there's I'm a BAFTA voter, just thought I'd slip that in. And I do think one of the things it's you
Okay.
don't tend to get a BAFTA if you don't deserve a BAFTA, but that doesn't mean that there aren't tons of people who do deserve a BAFTA who aren't getting one. So it's not saying, oh, these people do, but there are so many people who get overlooked and so much talent. I'm sure it is probably the same in your world, and we know it from friends who are musicians, friends who are in the arts, don't we? There are so many incredible people that don't get the recognition as well as the people who rightly get it. And in terms of the lockdown and what you've gone, I mean, I sort of joke, and as we all do on stage, how hard it was for comedians through gritted teeth, because it was shit for us, but it was also shit for hospitality. So you guys, and I know, and again, we won't dwell on it. I know there was a press furore, as there were about lots of kind of bigger name companies, people trying to sort of dig for dirt. But that must have been an incredibly stressful time for you, because it was your whole family's business, and nobody knew how long this was going to last. So how did you all cope through the pressures of lockdown?
Yeah, it was a strange one, that one. I mean, I go back in time. So when the pandemic hit and sort of March time, early March time, Boris Johnson came out and said something along the lines of, you know, restaurants should probably close, and but we're not going to close them, and old people shouldn't go to them. You know, this complete kind of hands-off kind of typical current conservative, oh, if you smoke, you choose to smoke, and that kind of ridiculous kind of liberalism that doesn't make any sense. And so we were left in a situation where we were coming out of a winter. So we're a seasonal business. We lose money for 8 months of the year. So for 8 months a year, we're loss making it. For 4 months a year, we make all our money for the year. So coming out in March, just before Easter, is our lowest cash time. We have no cash. We're in deep into our overdraft. And this came out, and we were looking at, we had 40 grand in the bank, you know, and our payroll, next payroll was 500 grand in, you know, a couple of weeks. And we were in a situation where we were going bust, like within weeks. We're a 45-year-old business that turns over enough money to be fine, you know, like in a normal year, every year we're quite profitable. But we just, it was just the timing. And, you know, we were then the furlough scheme came out, and that pushed our kind of we're going to go bust date to midsummer. So we're thinking, right, if we can open in summer, because of furlough, we'll survive. But if we don't, we're still going bust. So the Daily Mail article came out, which was a bizarre article because it basically said Rick Stein's basically, we didn't refuse to pay anyone. We were just saying, right, we haven't got the money for the payroll. The furlough scheme starts. When the furlough scheme starts, we'll backdate all the pay. But at the moment, we haven't got any money. There's,
So it was a
so you'll
cash
get it
flow
all.
situation,
But
not a
the,
point of principle of not
yeah.
paying people. Yeah.
No. And but the difference with us is that we went out straight away and told all our staff. We said to everybody, rather than just let them realize in 2 weeks' time they weren't getting paid, we told them early. And I think somebody leaked that to the press. So the story was we weren't paying our staff. It wasn't. The story was when furlough money comes in, we will back pay you for these 2 weeks, and then you'll get the 80% that everybody's using, because we can't afford to pay the staff at the moment. We've got no money. We're going bust. And everybody in the business understood that. Because we basically said, look, this is the situation. You've got 2 weeks. And so you can go and speak to your landlord, speak, you know, all the things that were coming out that people were able to mitigate costs. We didn't want to just drop it on them 2 weeks' time. If we'd waited 2 weeks, the story would never have gone, because it would have just been like Rick Stein has furlough. But
And you'd have done
and it
exactly
was
the same thing without the courtesy of telling your staff first.
exactly, yeah, exactly. So, but the Daily Mail came out, and I, you know, again,
You came in
probably
guns
I've learned,
blazing. I was like, that's ginger hair for you. We don't take that shit lying down.
But then you just then you realize, you know, it's like the internet and social media. Like I was going for people because they personal attacks on the old man. I'm like, I'm going to gun for him because it's like it's not, you know, it's ad hominem kind of Rick Stein is this, that, and the other. I'm just going, no, I'm not having that. Like if you know, I'll go out to bat for him. And then I realized these people are just wankers. They're just wankers. And then, I mean, I remember one guy. It was very funny, you know, because the first thing I do when I kind of go against a troll is I'll just go like basic stuff. Like it's the same as you know, if you read something on the internet, go and Google it before you start making an opinion on it because it's pretty basic kind of research. To go on his timeline, and I realize this is the most disturbed individual I've ever seen. I mean, there's, you know, kind of messages to famous sort of sex working porn stars and urination and all this kind of weird, bizarre stuff on his timeline. And I'm going, like, you're trolling my dad, but then two tweets behind, you're kind of asking somebody to urinate on you. And it's, and you realize I'm like, you know what? I'm probably just gonna just
Let
gonna
this die down.
leave these people alone. And actually, it was Steph McGovern was you know, who's now a very good friend. She said, and I was having some trouble with it. Was on the show and was still recording the show during lockdown, and I was having some trouble. And she came into my room. And she said, "Look, I've had a lot of this, you know, over my career,
She
you know,
has, yeah.
because of her sexuality." And she's, you know, a strong, like, funny woman like yourself, and you get a lot. I mean, worse than I've ever had. And she said, "Listen, all they're trying to do is they're just trying to affect your life. You're that they want to know that you're sat there thinking of them. That's all they care about. And it's like, and it doesn't matter. Just put it to bed. Just." You've got a family, go and speak to them. Because at the time, I was getting angry. I was like set on my phone and going at these people. And Lucy and the kids were there. And I'm missing all this time. We're in lockdown. We can hang out. So yeah, that was a bit of a rough period for me. And I kind of, you know, obviously it was really rough for the business. And you know, and obviously being in Padstow and being a significant employer, there's a lot of kind of rumors going around. And there was, you know, it's tough. It's tough to own a business in a town. I mean, I've, you know, that's as small as Padstow when things aren't great, because when things are going well, people are just like, you know, it's successful, everyone's kind of making money and everyone's working. But when there's a threat that that business might not be there, it was amazing to see how Padstow kind of rallied round and actually supported us, which normally you would never imagine, because there's always people just going, "Oh, Rick's ruined, you know, Padstow used to be great in the 70s." And I'm like, people who lived there in the 70s were like, it was shit, like the fishing fleet was going downhill and there was no tourism, and you know, it was a, you know, it wasn't great, but rose-tinted spectacles being what they are. But actually, when there was real trouble, it was just like, you know, it's a bit like a family. It's like we can have a go at them in Padstow, but the you lot on the outside can't have a go at Rick.
Yeah.
So it was really kind of nice, the you know, the kind of the community spirit of lockdown and all the kind of cooking we did for people and all the stuff that every lot of restaurant businesses didn't during that time. But it was stressful, and but to be honest, nothing like being in your industry. Nothing like comedy. Nothing like nightclubs. I mean, you know, I kept saying, like, people go, "Oh, it's so hard, must be so hard in hospitality." I'm like, "Yeah, but we reopened, you know, in events or in like nightclubs and comedy clubs. These sort of, they had no, they had nothing. They had zero kind of. We had little lights at the end of tunnels, you know, of the little opening in July
Although
of
we did have less
2020."
overheads, a lot of, I think that is the difficult thing. I mean, it depends. Some of the clubs, and there are clubs that went bust, and there are other clubs that had to be incredibly sort of savvy and hustly to keep going through it. And I'm still amazed actually how many clubs have survived. I was watching it thinking a lot of these clubs won't survive, and it was through kind of hustle that they did survive. But and you of all people should know, if a dodgy tabloid story comes out, you of all people should know that is tomorrow's chip paper. So I can't believe
Yeah,
that Steph
exactly.
McGovern had to tell you that.
I got
But
stuck. Yeah.
I was going to say that I want to ask you the three questions I ask everybody, but I just before I do that, in terms of Cornwall, and as I said, you and I have a sort of you have a very big connection there, that you're brought up there, and I've always been going there since a child and have a place down there. I'm one of the much hated second home holiday home owners down there, but hey, there we are. That's who I am, and that's all there is to it.
Have you
But
seen the film? Have you seen Bait, the movie?
yes.
The Mark Jenkins movie, yeah, okay.
We'll put a link to that in the
Yeah.
show notes for anyone that doesn't know what we're talking about.
Great movie.
But you're doing so. Cornwall is a place that, and it is a very sort of well, there's a reason lots of people go to it and love it. And I it takes quite a lot of time, obviously, for me to drive down to Cornwall, and I do rent the place out most of the year. But whenever I get down to Polruan, which is where my place is, I'm just like, God, you know, this is. Yeah, it's just a whole other world, really. And I still think it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. And it still literally takes my breath away. So that there is a sort of, I think people who love Cornwall have it somewhere kind of deep in our heart and soul. But I was going to ask you, I feel like I know lots about Cornwall, but I did not know. So you're hosting the Rock Oyster Festival. Just tell me, is that a new thing? I'd never heard of that before.
No, it's been going in different guises for about 10 years. I think it's sort of come and gone obviously during COVID, but yeah, it's a sort of a little family festival, and they've asked us to kind of create the, which sounds crazy, but to create the kind of chefs lineup, and then the music kind of, they sort of said, oh, do you like the Happy Mondays? I'm like, yeah, of course. I mean, Bez's maracas were, you know, a mainstay of my growing up. So it's a lovely little festival. It's really, I mean, it's on the banks of the Camel. It's got amazing views, and it's really nice when you actually work with people who are really organised. There's people who, you know, we went and did a site visit the other day, and they've done all the sort of, you know, they know exactly how everything's going to look. And then that really amazes me, because I'm just like phoning up chef friends again. Do you want to, like Gizzy Erskine and people like that, and that saying, oh, do you want to come and do this festival? And they're like, yeah. And they feel like I've done loads of work, which all I've done is phone mates and said, do you want to come and, you know, and I'll compare and sort of host.
No, and I saw you were comparing, I was like, don't get in my grill with your thing that some of us are making a living out of. And is it music and before I get pissy about that, is it music and cookery? It's not a comedy festival, is it?
No, we don't have any comedians at the moment. But it's interesting how, you know, the first music and food festival I ever did was Latitude, you know, when food was actually put on a stage, you know. This was back in 2012 or 13, and Gizzy was hosting it. And I remember thinking, God, this is a bit weird, isn't it? It's like, you know, food has become like, you know, worthy of a festival. I'm not so sure about that. It's not comedy, it's not music, it's not the things you associate with kind of, you know, good festivals. But actually now it does seem that people are quite keen. And again, I don't understand why people seem to trust chefs to kind of, you know, tell them what to do in cooking. But also, for some reason, we're also supposed to be experts on geopolitics and sustainability and all this kind of stuff. And actually, if people realise that I sit in the back of my dirty car eating a Rustler hamburger every now and again, I don't think they'd ever listen to me again.
Well, you've said it now. Do you know the comedian George? Do you know George Egg? The comedian George Egg.
Yeah,
I work with him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The snack guy,
yeah, but he's, I don't know if you've ever seen his shows, but he is so good at bringing the two things together. And he's exactly, I always think when I think of him, that's exactly how you feel you want to hear somebody talking about and behaving with food. So yeah, and is I'm surprised he's not been banging on your door when he's heard about the Rock Oyster Festival. So we'll put a link to that, and it's on the Camel Estuary, I should say. You said on the Camel.
Yeah.
So for anyone
who
doesn't know, it's not on an actual animal.
No, it's not on a. Yeah.
You're not riding it on a camel.
No. I'm trying to think of the name of camels. What's the one with one hump? Dodecahedron? No, that's a shape.
No, it's a
dromedon.
I should really know this with a son who's a zookeeper. Dromedary. Is it dromedary?
Like, I think there's more. I think I heard the other day there's more camels in Australia than anywhere else in the world.
Really?
I should have to go and look. Yeah, I'll go and look later on.
Yeah, no doubt you will. Well, given that I've made you do this before 8 in the morning, you've got a whole day ahead of you to do your research. Namaste, motherfucker. What would you pick as your namaste, motherfucking life-changing moment?
It's going to sound corny, but so it was meeting Lucy. So when I I shot a TV show down here in Southwest Australia. So it's Margaret River region. It's a wine-growing region. I'd just come out of a really bad relationship and was very, and that sounds bizarre, but I was very angry, very, wouldn't say misogynistic is the wrong word, because I'm not at all, but very pissed off. And I was kind of like, you know, fuck this and fuck relationships. And I'm just going to, you know, being a bit of a dick, to be honest. Didn't like the version of myself that existed between sort of, when I landed, which was like the 5th of January, and when I met Lucy, which was like the 23rd or 4th of January. But I was shooting a TV show. It was my first ever show on my own, and I was down in Augusta, and we met on the set. Typical kind of, you know, don't screw the crew, whatever the phrase is, you know. But, you know, she was my she was my home economist, and I was just straight away, bang. I don't know what about her, whatever it was. Her dad was directing me. I didn't know it's her dad. I was kind of like besotted. And but I, you know, by the first week in February, she'd moved to England, and I've been in love ever since. And I never believed in love at first sight. And I never believed that the person that landed in Perth, that person could be the person that I am now. And not only was it my first ever TV show, which was great for my career, and you know, it wasn't, Rick wasn't connected to it in any way, and all these kind of other things which were important, but it was more that I could not believe that I'd go from this angry, horrible kind of, you know, 35-year-old knob that was probably going to cause all sorts of problems to lots of people because he was just angry, and then to this loved up kind of puppy dog with two kids and just never been happier. So it would be that. I mean, it's corny and it's people, you know, but it's true.
It gives me hope that could happen. I just need to go to Perth and get my own TV show and it's game on.
Exactly. But that love at first sight thing, I was like, yeah, sure. And people always say, yeah, all right. And then there we go. Happy days.
And how long ago? I know your kids are, what are they now? Your little boy and girl?
Three and two.
How long have you guys been together?
5 years. Yeah, just gone. We just celebrated 5 years in January this year. So, yeah.
How did she feel about it? Did she know Cornwall? Because it's quite a specific kind of a place. So going from Perth to Cornwall, how was that for Lucy?
She went to Chelsea Arts School, so she had been in London before, so she understood. I did sell it to her a bit like, it's a bit like Australia. It's the closer you get to Australian lifestyle, but in England. And I think she didn't realise that I'd left out the weather.
Yeah,
apart from the weather. But people in Cornwall, you know, the surfing and that kind of thing. But she's much more into art and kind of cities than kind of the beach, which was, you know, something she didn't tell me at the time. In that early period of relationships where you like, you know, you claim to do all these sorts of things that you then roll back on and go, you know what, I'm not, I yeah. really like the beach. She likes the beach, but she's not like an Australian, I want to be at the beach all day long sort of thing. She's much more into art galleries and painting, which is actually much more like, I love surfing, don't get me wrong, it's my exercise, but I do love culture, you know, as well.
So she's adapted well and you go back and forth. Presumably she wasn't able to go back to Perth for quite a while. Is this your first trip back for a while?
Yeah, 2 years. So again, like her mum and dad were over when Arlem, our youngest, our daughter was born, which was, yeah, December of 2019. So they left basically just before COVID. And then, so we've been over here, we were over here for 8 weeks. So all the family gets to see her and we're getting married in June back in Cornwall. So it was really sort of come over and see the relatives that, you know, she's got a big extended Italian family here, so the ones that won't be able to travel because, you know, COVID and other things. So we've just sort of come over and done a bit of a tour with the kids, and you know,
what one in the gene war of Italian colouring versus ginger, what's one out with the kids?
One all.
Oh, one all. That's nice.
One apiece. The daughters. The daughter again. Like we were saying about the ginger hair when I was a kid was very much like. It wasn't as cool, but now apparently it's very cool. Like you know, my daughter's hair is like your color, very similar to your color, and it's like, you know, Ed Sheeran, Prince Harry. You know, when I was a kid, it was Mick Hucknall. You know, and it, with the greatest one in the world, it wasn't much of an idol for me growing up. Whereas I think people feel very differently about ginger hair now. So it's great for her, and yeah, the boy is much more Lucy's family's coloring. So it's interesting and one all.
I didn't manage to have either kid with ginger hair. My brother and I are both ginger. My parents aren't, and my kids aren't. My son has a ginger beard, but his hair is not ginger. So if he shaves his beard off, you have no sign of the ginger having carried through. I should add that he's 24. He's not like 7 with a hormone disorder. And what would you pick, Jack, as your favourite joke?
Okay. It's a bit of a long one. So, if you've got time,
Shaggy Dog Story, ahoy!
It's a Shaggy Dog Story. So there's a kid. He's called Jimmy, and he loves clowns, and yeah, his whole life he's loved clowns. He's got pictures of clowns on his walls and this, that, and the other. And his mum comes into the room one day and says, "Oh, the circus is coming to town." He says, "What?" He's like, "Oh, amazing!" They go down to the circus, and he's there, and all the usual circus stuff's happening, and he's just waiting for the clowns and the animals come out, blah blah blah. Then the clowns come out and they're, you know, doing all their thing. And they say, "Oh, we'd like somebody from the audience to come down." So he's like, "Nee, nee, nee." So he comes, they pick him out. He comes down to the front. They're like, "Right, we're going to bring out some animals." So he brings out the first animal, a lion. So, "Oh, what's that?" And Jimmy's like, "It's a lion." Everyone, big round of applause. And then he brings out a giraffe. And What's that? That's the giraffe. He says, yeah, well done, big round of applause. And out comes a donkey. And they say, what's that? And Jimmy's like, that's an ass. And the clown goes, no, you are. And the whole crowd just bursts out laughing. And Jimmy walks back completely dejected. Spirals into kind of, you know, depression, doesn't go out, doesn't talk to anyone. His mum and dad can't figure out what to do. And then, you know, as he gets a bit older, they say, look, you know, there's a little after school class on kind of rhetoric and the art of kind of like, you know, obviously you didn't have anything that you could sort of say back to this guy. So this clown, so, you know, maybe learn. So he goes in there and he excels at it. And they're like, you know, you're really, really good at this. You know, we recommend that you go to, you know, this special school that does all about rhetoric and it's, you know, about, you know, the art of kind of wordplay. Goes there, aces that, goes to university, ends up as a professor of you know, the art, you know, he's written books about the art of coming back and heckling and all this kind of stuff. And one day he's in the faculty lounge, told you it was a long one, he's in the faculty lounge and one of his students comes in and says, what's your motivation? He said, well, I tell them the story about the clown and the ass. And he said, well, like, you know, you're the world leading kind of expert on the art coming back. Why don't you find this fucker and, you know, nail him, you know, we'll come with you, you know? Oh yeah, maybe not. Anyway, the kid comes back and says, look, like the clown, the same circus is coming back to town. Like, perfect. He's all right, fair enough. He goes in there, usual sort of stuff. Circus comes out, blah, blah, blah. Then the clowns come on. We want somebody from the audience. He's gone, put his hand up. No one else put their hand up. So this guy comes forward and he's like, it's the same fucking clown, you know? Comes forward and he's like, you're a bit older than normal, but you know, whatever. Brings out the lion. What's that? It's a lion. And the next time comes out, brings out, what's that? It's a giraffe. Brings out the donkey. He said, what's that? He's an ass. And the clown says, no, you are. And he says, fuck you, clown.
You know, they always say the longer the setup.
The funny thing is, if I was a big internet geek back in the day, and if you go online to, like, you know, Reddit or whatever, and you look at the best jokes, what's the best joke? There'll always be a fuck you clown, and people are like, what does that even mean? But it's one of those jokes that just, I don't know, the more you think about it, the more funny it gets. So yeah. Sorry, thanks for bearing with me. And
no, it's good. And we do, the only thing is it won't make the Christmas cracker episode because the whole episode's only 7 minutes and that would just be you and one other. But but it's a very solid standalone.
I can live with that.
And if you were to give one bit of life advice to anybody listening, what would it be?
Have a good time all the time. No, I think it would be your industry, whatever industry you're in, like I said earlier on, it's not as big as you think. And just remember that, because something that you say and do, and especially in this modern age of Twitter and social media and things that you say and do, you just have to be careful, because you know, when you get to the position where something might happen for you, you know, what you've said in the past might come back to bite you. So just always remember that, you know, the industry, whatever it might be, it might seem massive when you're young, and like, but actually it's small, and people talk. So be nice, just be nice. Dad said that to me once. He said, I said about TV and I was doing TV. He said, what bit of advice would you give me? He said, be on time and be nice, because it's a small industry and everyone knows. And that's probably why Lucy fell in love with me.
Namaste, motherfucker. That was Jack Stein. Every episode, I pick a thing inspired by my guest that I am going to do. And this week, I'm keeping it simple. I'm going to boil an egg, which is about the one thing I can actually do. It's actually hard to do it. I do it very well. And I'm going to practice slicing bread using my arm like a saw, Rick Stein style. Next stop, Bake Off. So that's it for this week. Please do remember, as always, to rate, review and recommend the podcast. We absolutely love that you support us and listen to us. And we love all the lovely comments you send to us. That's a lot of love, isn't it? We will be back in your feed next Monday, as always, when I'll be talking to one of my favourite comedians, Esther Manito.
Getting a lot of negative comments about a woman that goes out and does a job that's of, you know, of an evening when you're a mum.
Namaste, Motherfuckers was written and presented by me, Callie Beaton, and produced by Mike Hansen and Karusha Dhami for Pod People Productions, with music by Jake Yap. I'm Callie Beaton. Until next time, motherfuckers.